Medial, digital, genial. Behaltet den Überblick bei Medien macht Meinung, dem Podcast des Digital Journalism Fellowship der Hamburg Media School. Alles zu den digitalen Trends und Innovationen jetzt bei Medien macht Meinung.
Herzlich willkommen, mein Name ist Anja Kollroß und heute geht's ums Business. Wenn ich an den Beruf des oder der Journalistin denke, dann denke ich vor allem an Kreativität, Storytelling, aber auch an Hartnäckigkeit und ein Gespür fürs Detail. Woran ich weniger denke, was für viele aber immer wichtiger wird, Unternehmertum. Einige möchten aus dem Hamsterrad der Redaktion entfliehen, andere wiederum werden gekündigt und sind gezwungen, ohne großen Verlag im Rücken zu veröffentlichen. Mit der Digitalisierung steigen die Möglichkeiten, es mit der Gründung wenigstens zu versuchen. Wenn aus Journalistinnen Unternehmerinnen werden, darüber möchte ich in dieser Folge sprechen. Das mache ich natürlich nicht alleine, sondern habe mir Jeremy Kaplan dazu eingeladen. Mr. Kaplan ist Director of Teaching and Learning an der Newmark Graduate School of Journalism an der City University of New York. Seitdem Schwerpunkt dort unter anderem Entrepreneurship im Journalismus. Außerdem lernt Jeremy Kaplan auch als Dozent genau zu dem Thema am Digital Journalism Fellowship. Hello, Mr. Kaplan. Thank you for your time and for being my guest in today's podcast episode.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we can't spare the corona pandemic when talking about the current situation for journalists. But I would like to start with like a positive perspective on it. What do you think? Are there any chances during the corona pandemic for journalists to start now with their own business?
Despite all of the challenges that we're facing in the journalism industry, with 11,000 journalism layoffs in 2020 alone in the US, for example, despite all these challenges, it is actually an amazing and exciting time for journalism in many ways. It's a period of renaissance. It's a period of growth and exploration and experimentation in journalism. And here's what I mean. Independent journalists from all over are creating new products and services to serve niche audiences. And they are doing this more easily than ever before, in many cases more profitably than ever before, more sustainably than ever before. And they're using new formats to reach people in new ways that fit in with the new lives people are living, particularly during this crisis where people are at home and spending more time on devices than they have in the recent past. So I think that it's a time for very fertile growth and a new era for journalism that's beginning.
Mm-hmm. During the corona pandemic, we saw a rapid rise of digital platforms, new tools, innovations. What would you say, which media product had the most impact on you so far?
I think in many ways we have a schizophrenic view within the world of journalism. We on one day are feeling very anxious, very depressed, very demoralized about what's happening in our industry and the changes and our uncertainty that lies ahead. And on other days, we experience the excitement of the new possibilities we have. So I want to mention a few examples of the kinds of things people are creating. Not only are they creating podcasts to the tune of thousands and thousands of new podcasts every month appearing on the iTunes database, which powers the podcast platforms that many of us use, but they're creating newsletters and they're creating niche sites and local sites around the US and around the world. So the LION, the local independent online news publishers organization here in the US, which is a really strong collection of local news organizations, now has almost 300 members. And they're just a fraction of the total of local publications. And many of those are finding new ways to serve local communities with information about the pandemic and how it's affecting the community and how restaurants are addressing the challenges they're facing and how rent and other local issues are affecting people who live in their locality. So that to me is a good example of local news emerging, local news outlets emerging to address the news desert problem we have here in the US and a problem that exists elsewhere in Europe and Asia and Africa as well. So there are definitely challenges and we feel them and we're aware of them on many days, but on other days we are optimistic because of all of these exciting new outlets.
Yeah, during the corona pandemic, we saw a rapid rise of those digital platforms, new tools, innovations. What would you say, what new media product had the most impact on you during the past
months. I think newsletters have been a tremendous resource for staying in touch with individual journalists, hearing from them with an authentic take on different issues without the intervention or intermediation of a news organization that waters down the personality and voice of the journalist. So I subscribe to dozens and dozens of newsletters that provide me with a really interesting and informative view of what's happening in different areas, whether in business coverage or coverage of technology, which I'm interested in, or coverage of particular political issues, environmental issues like climate change, health and science issues. So I've been really enjoying this renaissance in independent news coverage provided through newsletters. And there are so many new ones that have emerged that are just, I think, doing a great job of covering things in really interesting ways. And I think that is pointing to a new kind of future for journalism that is not strictly the domain of the large institutional organizations, but also the domain of independent journalists who have their own voice and their own approach, their own style, their own reporting tenacity, and who have a direct relationship with their readers.
It's interesting to talk about newsletters because I always thought, oh my God, there are already too many newsletters in the world. But now I see it as well. They're increasing. Do you think now it's the time where it's easier to make money out of newsletters and to reach a bigger audience?
I do, and there's evidence for it. There are more than 100,000 people already paying for Substack newsletters. So that's not people subscribing, that's people paying. So there's a large, much larger number of people subscribing, but more than 100,000 are paying, and that number is growing quickly. And that means they're paying, you know, $5 to $8 US dollars a month, typically, sometimes $10 or $15 US dollars a month. And people like Emily Atkin, a journalist who covers climate change in a newsletter at heated.world, she has moved her entire career over to Substack. And Substack isn't the only platform, but it's one of the leading ones here in the US, where dozens of big name journalists have left major publications to create their own independent publications. And many of them are able to make a living this way. And we're just at the beginning of this era. But if you think about the math, you don't need a huge number. You don't need millions of people to read and subscribe to your newsletter, right? If you have a few thousand people ultimately who are willing to pay even a few dollars a month, you start to be able to support an individual journalist. Now that's not going to be a multi-million dollar business necessarily, but if you're an independent journalist and you want to support yourself on a basic kind of six-figure salary, it's now conceivable. Now that doesn't mean everyone can do it, and it doesn't mean it's easy. But there are many people who are doing this. Emily Auster writes about pregnancy and parenting. There are all sorts of people writing about sports. Matt Stoller writes about politics and monopolies and sort of big business. There are so many. Ben Thompson writing about business and technology. There's so many. Lee Jin writing about the passion economy. There's so many people who have created their niche on Substack, and they attract people's attention because of the quality of work that they're doing and the consistency of that work. And it's very simple, you know, for journalists to create their own brand and their own identity and their own essentially publication. It's very simple. It takes a few minutes, and they can do the work, focus on the journalism work that they're so good at. And the platform makes it relatively easy.
You said they're paying a few dollars per week or per month. Are they paying like for additional content? Like they have like more articles on their website, or how is it financed?
There are a variety of different approaches. And many journalists are still finding, you know, identifying what are the extra components they can offer to provide extra value for subscribers. In some cases, they provide some additional content, behind the scenes content, you know, additional transcripts, full transcripts of interviews they've done, or full data sets of data work that they're doing. Or in other cases, they'll invite subscribers or members, if they're operating on a membership structure, which is slightly different, they'll invite them to live events that they have virtually. These days, or they will provide them with access to a Slack discussion group or Facebook discussion group, for example, or they'll send them every few months a summary of some of the best material that they've produced. So there are a variety of different kinds of kind of rewards or benefits that they offer for their premium subscribers.
We talked about newsletters, but do you think there are other products which could be a good alternative for me if I want to leave my newsroom and become an independent journalist? What would be your recommendation?
I think ultimately it comes down to offering value to people in a niche area and on a topic of specialization that you have, whether it's a demographic kind of specialization for a particular group of people or a geographic specialization for a particular locality or a psychographic specialization on a particular topic of personal or professional interest. So some people are experts in hockey or volleyball, or they might be experts in issues of professional interest like commodity trading in Southeast Asia. And if you bring a specialization or a unique perspective, if you can provide access to news about China in Arabic and you can do it well, if you can provide some specialization in whatever topic area it is, whatever locality it is, the platform is really a matter of what best serves your community of interest. So if, for example, the people you're aiming to reach are unlikely to read newsletters, if they're more likely to access messaging services, for example, there are now platforms that you can use to reach people through messaging, through SMS messages, for example, and enable them to subscribe to SMS messages, or through audio platforms like podcasting. Niche sites also have value. I think it's difficult to drive people to many different websites on any given day. So I think niche sites that people are creating typically are best paired with additional outreach methods like newsletters or other kinds of more engaging outreach, including podcasts. But there are multiple platforms, multiple ways of creating different kinds of products. I would also say I think there's an opportunity for experimentation in new kinds of product. I think you can create a product for a limited period of time, for example, a product related to the Olympics that just lasts for that period, or related to Davos, or related to an election, an upcoming election. Those are all kinds of things that you can create for a limited period of time. Not all products and services created in journalism have to be indefinite or permanent, because sometimes that is unnecessary.
If you do that, you have to do it without a huge support by a media house, and I think that's quite challenging. You mentioned personal branding before, and I think before you can send out your own newsletter, you have to build your personal branding in order to reach a huge audience you can send your newsletter to, right?
I think the work needs to speak for itself. The work needs to have value for people as a starting point. So that's not sufficient in and of itself, but it's necessary. So you have to have something to offer to a particular community of that's of value to that group of people. So assuming you have that, assuming you have something to say, some information to provide, some insight to bring, some expertise or experience that you can bring that adds something of value to people you're aiming to reach, then the question is, how do you make them aware of the fact that you're offering this, right? How do you build a community and grow a community and audience around the product or service? And that's really challenging. It's absolutely challenging, and it will be challenging in any field, right? If you're starting a new restaurant, if you're starting any kind of new product or service, it's always challenging. So the question is really, who are the people you're serving and who are you creating value for, and where are they now, and how can you reach them and kind of share what you're creating with them so that they see it and can try it and can enjoy it and benefit from it and become part of your community? So there are a lot of different strategies for that, and it's not something that is simple or easy or fast. If there were a quick fix, it would be great, but it wouldn't be realistic. But the reality is, in many cases, if you're dealing with content, you can go to existing content channels. So for example, if you're starting a new podcast, you can work with other podcasters, and sometimes having them share some of your initial content is a good way to build an initial audience. For many podcasts, that's how they've grown, by basically having their initial podcasts delivered on other podcast streams. That's a collaborative kind of barter system that works well in the podcast world. And similarly, it works well in the newsletter world. So I, for example, have a newsletter myself called Wonder Tools about useful digital tools. And one of the things that's helped me grow an audience is writing guest posts for other newsletters that have a very large audience. And whenever I do that, or others I know and teach do that kind of thing, where they're publishing guest posts or publishing content on other people's platforms, some percentage of people on those platforms will invariably then subscribe if they find it to be of value. So those are a couple of examples of specific strategies. But it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of time. And those who are expecting an instant fix or instant success will often be frustrated if it takes more time than they expect. But the evidence is there that those who stick to it and have something of value, and I want to emphasize that, because it doesn't mean that everyone who wants to create whatever blog or website or newsletter they want, they're all gonna succeed. But those who have something really valuable to offer, they have many different ways to now reach people. And that's something that's never been true before. And I think we should recognize that. You know, typically in the past, you always needed to work within the confines of a large organization to reach people en masse. And that's simply not true anymore. Now, I don't mean to say there's no advantages of working for organizations. I think there are a lot of reasons that people do work for organizations. And I think organizations can provide a lot of support and value for people, particularly here in the US, where we have a healthcare system that requires employers to provide healthcare in many cases. So there are reasons that employers provide value to people, but it's an individual decision. And not everyone should feel a need to work for an organization. And some people would be better off working on their own and would enjoy that.
So assuming I have now my community, of course, I want to keep my community. And on the one side, it's about content, but on the other side, it's about audience engagement. I mean, big media houses, they have their dashboards, how to track the numbers and which article clicks best. What do I have to do when I'm alone? You know, that sounds like I have to play so many roles at the same time.
Yeah, so working on your own has challenges, right? One of the challenges is, as you said, you have to play different roles. You have to be the creator. You have to also be someone who's sharing content with the world. And you have to be thinking about sustainability, right? Those are the three core elements of entrepreneurial journalism, is thinking about the product, what you're actually creating, making sure you have value that you're offering and the journalism is good. Thinking about community, and that means building an audience, building a sustainable community around what you're doing. And sustainability, which is thinking about revenue streams, how you're going to actually bring in some money and manage costs. So those are three important things that you have to think about, and you have to play multiple roles, as you noted. And that's not for everyone. Some people prefer just to do their reporting and let the organization do everything else or do editing. But one thing that's nice about having those multiple roles is that you have more say in the work that you do and how you do it, when you do it, where you do it, who you're reaching, what voice you're using. There are a lot of constraints that organizations often place on us, and anyone who's worked in an organization understands that. And sometimes those are fine, and we manage them and we deal with them, but sometimes they limit our creativity, our freedom, our expression, our style, our voice, our personality. Sometimes they limit how and where we do our work and when we do our work in ways that are confining and uncomfortable, or that go against our values. So I think there are reasons to be independent, and there are ways to manage the multiple roles. So for example, some people I know who work as independent podcaster or newsletter writers take a couple days where they're focused just on the content, just on creating and reporting and writing and editing. And then they may have another day in the week where they're focused on outreach and talking to potential sponsors, let's say, or looking at grant application opportunities, or looking at other ways to find partners to help with some of the work that they would rather not do, whether it's audio editing or editing a newsletter or copy editing or reaching out to potential sponsors. So there are ways to divide up your time so that you can focus on certain things on certain days and other things on other days. And there are also ways to bring in partners and collaborators so that you can focus on what you want to focus on and others can help with other aspects.
How easy is it to find the right sponsor or the right partner for me? Or what do you suggest? What would be a good way of approaching them?
Well, in many cases, it's about thinking about what products and services serve your audience well and finding authentic products and services that make sense for the people you're listening that are listening or reading you, and kind of providing value both to the reader or listener and to the organization that you're providing information about. But in many cases, there's a direct payment model that works quite well. So with newsletters, for the most part, many of them aren't bothering the sponsors at all. They're just saying to the reader, look, I'm creating something of value to you. And if this is a value to you and you want to support it, here's a simple way to do that. It's a few dollars a month. Or a few euros a month. And not everyone wants to do that, right? There's plenty of free content. And not everyone wants to pay for a particular newsletter or a podcast. But if you have a sizable readership that you grow, you don't need everyone to subscribe. You need a percentage. And what many Substack newsletter writers are finding is that they can convert, anywhere between 5 and 10% of their readers, their loyal readers, those who open up the newsletter on a regular basis, to become paid members. And it's a fairly simple proposition, and it's fairly simple for people to do. And on a platform like Substack, the platform takes 10%. So 90% goes to the creator. And you don't have a lot of technical costs, right? You're not paying for real estate or other kinds of costs that businesses sometimes are are paying for. So it goes often straight to the creator. And that can be quite helpful. There are some new platforms like Supercast.com and Glow.fm that allow you to create membership opportunities for podcasts as well. So the podcast realm is kind of joining the newsletter realm in terms of enabling people to pay in creative ways. Although it's still a bit easier at the moment to get paid subscribers for a newsletter than it is for a podcast.
Why is that so? Because there are already too many podcasts out?
Well, there are now more than 1.2 million global podcasts available in the centralized kind of podcast database that most podcast apps use. So there's a huge number, and that's challenging. But that's actually only part of the issue. The other part of the issue is just the mechanism of the network of podcasts and the platform and how people consume them. And as with YouTube, there's not a simple way to pay for a kind of subscription to a podcast that's built into many of the platforms or that was built in from the start. So people are kind of accustomed to free podcasts. And Amazon's Audible, which tried a paid podcast model, and Luminary, another kind of paid podcast platform, have struggled initially to kind of persuade people to pay for podcasts, which they're accustomed to getting for free. We've seen that change over the years in the cable TV industry. We've seen it change in the newsletter arena. And I think we may see it eventually change in the podcast arena, but it still takes some time. It's not quite as advanced yet because it's just something that people have grown accustomed to consuming for free thus far.
I think it's the same with online articles or online news platforms. When they started, it was all for free. And now we're getting used to pay for it. Or, I mean, we're more willing to pay for it, but it took some time. What do you think? Who is consuming those kind of new journalistic products? Is it a special group of people?
I think there's an era of slow journalism, much like there is slow food or kind of people being more selective about their journalism, much as they're more selective about their food. People are I think, choosing the brands that they interact with to a greater extent than they have in the past. They're more intentional about their choices of media and entertainment as they are with food and clothing and other products that they're purchasing. So I think there are kind of thoughtful consumers who are the ones who are maybe less apt to just swallow up whatever mainstream outlet that has been dominating a particular market in the past. And they're more apt to look around and say, you know, I'd like sports coverage of a particular team or particular sport in this particular way, right? Or I'd like to read science from an actual scientist who knows about this rather than reading from a news organization that I don't trust quite as much. Or I'd rather read from a business person who has spent years in this industry writing about venture capital than I would from a kind of general interest business reporter, and so on and so forth. People are interested in specialization because they realize the value of that expertise. And so I think thoughtful consumers are the ones who are the best targets for a lot of these specialty products. One other thing I would say is that, you know, we have a recognition now of the importance of DEI, what we call diversity, equity, and inclusion, and different voices that haven't been heard in journalism as much in the past and that need to be heard more. And one of the things that this kind of growth, renaissance, and independent journalism has enabled is voices of people from communities that have been underserved and underrepresented in the past. They're able to share their voice in an independent way that they haven't necessarily been able to do as easily in the past because of the constraints of news organizations and because of the lack of diversity within news organizations, et cetera. And so that also opens up the opportunity for people to speak to communities that haven't had someone speaking to them about their experiences. And that those are ethnic communities and racial communities and gender communities and all sorts of other communities that haven't been adequately represented. And that's enabled by this kind of direct relationship between the creator and the consumer. And that's why we launched the Journalism Creators Program at the CUNY Newmark Grad School of Journalism, is to enable and empower independent journalists, journalism creators, to do what they can do really well and what they have unique experience and capacity to do. And we want to empower them with some of these other skills that we've been talking about in terms of sustainability and building a community and building a product on a consistent basis, because these are things that historically journalists haven't been trained to do. We've been trained to write and report and edit, but we need increasingly to be able to do things in addition to those core things. Not instead of those things, but in addition to those things.
Do you think those kind of new and independent journalistic products can help to gain more trust in the journalism itself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a lot of concern about from people about the trustworthiness of journalists. Part of it is inspired by demagogues and politicians. In a recent study, by Eurobarometer, 47% of Europeans said they trust the written press. 47% said they do not. So they're even numbers. People are very skeptical of the press, many people, of the mainstream sort of large institutional press, to be clear. And yet they're actually much more apt to feel trustful of local publications and of publications by people that they know or that they listen to regularly or that they read in their inbox. So I do think that actually that the movement toward independent journalism actually does promise to help strengthen the trust people have in the information they're receiving, because they have a sense of who is actually writing this, whose voice they're listening to in the podcast or whose newsletter they're reading in a direct way. They have a more direct relationship, and because they kind of have a clear sense of what's happening and how it's happening and how it works. With traditional journalism organizations, I think in many cases we've failed, not in every case, but in many cases we've failed to be transparent and be clear about how we do the work that we do, why we choose the stories we choose, what one section means versus another section, analysis versus news versus opinion, etc. And we've created a kind of veneer of separation between ourselves and our readers, and that actually creates an artificial distance and eventually has led to some distrust or confusion about what we do and how we do it and why we do it. For example, a lot of the public in the US still thinks that news organizations are very profitable and are thriving, and they don't understand how we choose the stories we choose or how we do the reporting we do or what we withhold and what we don't withhold. And there's a lot of confusion among the public about what we do. And that's partly at the root of the lack of trust.
Don't you think this could reduce the number of media we are consuming? Because when you're saying, okay, people have their favorite newsletter, their favorite podcast, maybe they only now, getting their news from this person or from that media product. Maybe that's like a decreasing of different opinions. What do you think?
So I think, you know, we have a marketplace of ideas and a marketplace of information. And I think ultimately, just as Netflix allows great independent documentarians and filmmakers to rise to the surface, no matter what their background or origin or ethnicity, and whatever language they speak, and same with Spotify, these platforms allow people to do independent work that's then valued by others because of the quality of the work. For example, I just watched with my family recently, My Octopus Teacher. I mean, who would have thought a film about an octopus and a guy, you know, getting to know one another would become one of the great kind of shows of the year, of the period, or the popular ones. It allows new subjects to emerge, and so I think, and it, as I said, it allows new voices to emerge as well. So I think that it actually is a very open kind of freeing thing. You know, if you think about a food marketplace, where you have a lot of fruit vendors and vegetable vendors and other people selling their breads and cheeses and whatnot, you know, people can choose among those different vendors, right? And the quality of the products is going to eventually win out for those who have really great products. And the freedom that allows the consumers to choose is actually a helpful thing for the sustainability of the marketplace and for the quality of the products and for everyone involved. And so I'd like to think that the growth of a kind of independent journalism marketplace is a good thing both for the consumers and for the producers. It sets a high standard for journalism, because if a newsletter is not trustworthy or not consistent, or you don't feel you can understand or value the material you're getting, you can simply unsubscribe and find something else. And the easier it is to switch, right, the lower the switching costs, the more important it is for the organization or the independent journalist to establish and maintain that trust. So the market, in a sense, acts as a check on the trustworthiness and reliableness of the provider of the information. I do think there's a filter bubble issue. So we could have a challenge where people, for example, on the far right, subscribe only to news from publishers who are serving their pre-existing assumptions and listening to podcasts that only serve their pre-existing assumptions and watching, for example, Fox News here in the US, which is only serving their right-wing assumptions. I do think that's a challenge. Unfortunately, that's partly going to be up to us in terms of how we can develop a consumer culture that's more open-minded, and it's not a simple problem to fix. Just as, you know, our problem with obesity is a challenge and not easy to fix just by launching new good products of food. So there's no quick fix for that. It's a societal problem. It's a global issue. People want to consume what they want to consume, and that's human nature. And it's hard to change their wants and desires. That's, I think, goes to education and goes to a broader issue of our leadership and culture, which isn't something we can solve quickly or with a quick fix in journalism alone. But I do think that's a big challenge. And I wouldn't want to dismiss that. I think it's significant, something we need to think a lot about. I do think one positive area in that regard is apps and services that provide really great curation and aggregation, and that do so either algorithmically or in a human way. So Brain Pickings by Maria Popova is a good example. Arts and Leisure Daily is a website that curates things. Those are manual curation things that provide people a wide array of things outside of their personal areas of interest, and allows for serendipity, discovering things that are outside of your political or cultural filter bubble. And there are also our algorithmic tools that do this. Nuzzle is one I like a lot. It's an app that looks at what those who you are following in social media share and presents that to you, but also allows you to go outside of your bubble and find out what people outside of your social circles are sharing and reading that you might not be aware of. So there are some tools that are helpful in this realm to help us break through the filter bubble, but it's certainly a challenging area.
So we're almost at the end of this episode, and I always like to ask for the last question. What do you think, what will be the future like? I know it's always hard to tell, but just imagine 20 years from now, maybe, what do you think? Do we still consume the same kind of news products? Or will we have, I don't know, 15 or 20 newsletters per day for each topic we're interested in? What do you say?
I think we'll have our cake and eat it too. So I think we'll have both. I think what we've seen over time is that there tends to be a growth in marketplace of options and opportunities for people, right? And that means also a growth of competition. I think we will continue to see a flourishing of newsletters. We'll also see some newsletters that don't make it and that close up and fold up, right? Just like with any industry, any product. I think we'll see newspapers that continue to thrive. Some of the best ones that provide a unique value, right? That really serve their community with something distinct and don't just, you know, push out commodity news that's the same as all the other news that people are receiving. Those that provide something really distinct and unique value, those will survive and those will thrive because people want news. They want to have information about what the world around them, and that won't change. But I don't think we can assume that just because certain form factors have worked in the past, those will inevitably persist, right? Even if there's government support for those institutions, as there is in throughout Europe, I don't think that guarantees that those will be the dominant players. I think they will be in the marketplace. People will watch traditional TV just like they watch cable TV. But I think increasingly more of what they watch will be digital and on phones and on digital devices and in new platforms that arise to serve people in unique digital ways. And some new kinds of products will also engage people in new ways, right? I think, you know, there's a pop-up magazine, essentially journalism events organization, right? They would gather together and tell people real stories about real things in person, right? That obviously isn't possible now during the pandemic. But other ways of transmitting information through experiences and events, I think also will flourish because people want to connect with other people and other humans, again, assuming we can do that, again, post-pandemic. So the reason I mention that is just to say that I don't think we know all of the different platforms and distribution mechanisms that are going to be viable in the future. But I think we do know, if we look back at history and we draw from that there tends to be movement towards variety, towards a flourishing of different kinds of products and services, and that we can't assume that the things that have been successful in the past will be successful in the future. So I would expect more variety and more change, rapid change. And the core thing we have to remember and keep in mind is serving people with real information of value to them and understanding their needs and starting with that as a starting point. So in journalism, historically, in many cases, we've decided that we know what the main stories are. We know what to tell people, how to tell them, and we tell them with authority. And I think now we need to take a step back and start with the user in mind, the consumer in mind, the reader in mind, and what are their needs, what are their questions, what is their life like, where have they been represented, where have they not been represented adequately, and how are they best served, in what formats, and what delivery mechanisms, at what frequency, and what style, and what voice, And we need to question a lot of our assumptions about how we do journalism, how we deliver it, and how we monetize it. And if we do that, if we put the user first and focus on the user and the reader and start there, I think we'll be well positioned to create something that has lasting value because it provides lasting value.
Yeah, quite challenging times for journalism, but thank you, Mr. Kaplan, for giving us this positive or rather constructive perspective. I think that's, for once, it's nice to hear. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, thank you.
Das war die aktuelle Folge von Medien macht Meinung, den Podcast des Digital Journalism Fellowship der Hamburg Media School. Ich hoffe, wir hören uns auch beim nächsten Mal. Bis dahin, tschüss.